The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everyone here in person. And good morning, those of you, hello for those of you online. Maybe for some of you it's not morning. So happy to be here with you all. Nice to be together in person. I think one of the, as is well recognized now, that the lack of community has been a very big negative impact of the pandemic. And so to come together is pretty important for many people. And even if we're still wearing masks here. Can you hear me okay? Is that loud enough for everyone? So, and we are discussing ending the mask requirement here at IMC. We're like one of the last places, right, with this. Some people show up at the door and are completely surprised. How could this be? But we still are, and at least for this month, May, and it's a work in progress, but we're considering ending the masks in June. So, or ending them being required. They're optional and recommended after that. So the talk today could be titled Suffering as a Door to Go Through. And I think many of you know that one of the core aspects of Buddhism, or our kind of Buddhism, is addressing suffering. And the general idea, or the kind of the ultimate idea, that is that it's possible to end suffering, bring suffering to an end. And that's, you know, to be fully enlightened is to bring suffering to an end. And that's perplexing for some people. Like, how could that be, really? Like, am I still going to be human if I don't suffer at all? And so some of this has to do with how we define suffering. And I think that Dharma teachers like me seldom define it enough. We just assume everyone knows what it is. And we'll use the word suffering, 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 suffering until you suffer. What does he mean? What's going on here? And I think it's really reasonable to question what we mean by suffering, and to have say, what do you mean? What do you mean? Because, for example, does it mean all forms of sadness? Sadness feels uncomfortable. Therefore, because it's uncomfortable, does that mean we're not enlightened? You're not supposed to be sad anymore. And if you're going to be a good Buddhist, you have to stop being sad, please. Or no grief. Does it mean that you never get annoyed or irritated? Is that also is uncomfortable? So is that kind of, you know, crossing the line into suffering? That's not supposed to be. Never be heartbroken. You know, see some of the things going on in the world, and you're supposed to just kind of continuing, you know, singing happy songs and smiling, and you know, while Rome burns, or whatever it is. So, what about, you know, uncomfortable emotions? Is all of them supposed to go, or what? So, I think what's important to say is don't look to Buddhism to answer those questions I just raised. That makes you more, then now you're suffering more, or frustrated more, because wait a minute, the Buddhism is supposed to have answers and supposed to describe things. I think what Buddhism is trying to do, at least the kind of Buddhism that I like to espouse or that I see, is encouraging us to take a deep, good look at life. And discover for ourselves what's going on. In a sense, answer those questions for ourselves. The questions that are really good, what is suffering, and is some suffering inherent and part of even an enlightened life? Or are some forms of suffering, are all suffering going to go? And But what is suffering? What does that mean? What are we talking about here? So for you to answer that question for yourself, and that requires stepping in and taking a good look at whatever you might generally consider to be suffering. So as some of you know, the bumper sticker I think Buddhists should have for their cars is, "I stop for suffering." Because to really take a good look, to enter into suffering, not to suffer better or more, but to do the opposite of running away from it, the opposite of avoiding it, and the opposite of collapsing with it, or the opposite of kind of living under the burden or the struggle of some of this emotional distress, dismay, pain that is so common to human life. So to stop and take a good look at it, so I call it a door. And so calling a door that you go through is maybe a paradigm shift for how many people address their own suffering, their own distress and stress and pain and challenges. Because often we want to avoid it. And we want to make it go away, but we want to like push it away or just cut it off or take a drug so we don't have to feel it or something. Or be distracted. But to stop and take a really good look and think of it as a door that you have, we develop a lot of faith or a lot of confidence, this is a good thing to do. And that's a paradigm shift. I've known people who've taught this kind of idea that you should turn around and be present for your pain and your suffering, physical pain even, and really look at it. And I've known that some people, maybe some of you here today already, get angry. No, this is terrible. I'm here to get rid of it, not to have it, not to look at it. I have to look at it and feel it even more? My gosh, this is like, that's not, I thought Buddhism promised the end of it, and now I have to, Yes, but... But this paradigm shift, this kind of almost a radically different way of looking at suffering, where we don't see it as a burden, we don't see it as an oppression, but we see it as a door that we go through to get to the other side. And as we go through that door, as we turn towards it, then we can start looking more and more deeply to understand the nature of that suffering, and we can answer the question, which suffering is appropriate to live with and maybe accept and maybe even appreciate as part of the richness of being a human being? And what part of the suffering that we have is just really optional and unnecessary and a product of the odd machinations of my mind and heart that don't really have to operate that way? And so I see how that works, the operating system of certain kinds of suffering that comes from what's, the unfortunate, unnecessary functioning of my mind, and that I'm happy to let go of. Maybe it's not easy to let go of it, but I see now. So we start seeing a distinction between it all. So in this regard, I want to suggest that this investigation of suffering is supported by taking a good look at three different aspects of things that could be called suffering, just inherently, some people might say it, or are sometimes the kind of thing that Buddhists call suffering, the kind of suffering that we want to bring to an end, and some of it maybe is not something you can reasonably bring to an end. And you have to learn how to live with that. And how do you live with it wisely? How do you live with the suffering that you can't get rid of ever in human life? How do you live with it so you don't add suffering on top of it that is optional, that is not necessary to have? So that's the investigation. And each of you will have a different answer today and tomorrow and in a month and a year. And your answer will change over time because the answer will change a lot by by number of things, by how well you understand yourself, and the state of your mind, the mindset that you live under. And the quality of consciousness, the quality of the mind, provides a very different vantage point for understanding our life, understanding ourselves, understanding what's important. So it's not just simply answering the question from the state of mind you happen to have today, which maybe is a perfectly good state of mind to have when you're in that state of mind. But to have, the way we see the world changes when we're more concentrated, for example, when we're more peaceful, when we see aspects of this world that are invisible to us to this state. So to keep asking these questions and seeing it in new ways. So in three areas. And these areas I want to talk about are plain and simple discomfort, emotional pain, and the complex of ideations that belong to me, myself, and mine. The kind of the whole ideations around identity and self and all that. So to dip into these in a deep way, these are doors to really address and maybe go through. So we start with discomfort. I'm sitting here right now, and I'm uncomfortable in my right leg. Somehow something shifted in my old age. I used to sit comfortably like this for years, and now there's a degree of discomfort and pain that I didn't used to have. So I'm just kind of, I don't know if writing it off is the right language. I'm just kind of like, okay, you know, maybe that things change. And I was very comfortable for many decades. And that was nice. And now I'm not so comfortable. And maybe that'll last for a couple of decades. And then it's all shifting all the time. And actually, I've had all kinds of discomfort in my meditation career that's about 50 years old now, they've come and gone at different times. And you know, so it's part and parcel of meditation for me is being with discomfort. I would say that I have no suffering or barely any suffering by this pain that I feel going down my leg here right now. It's just, okay, you know, it's just, okay. I don't give it much attention. I give it enough attention to make sure that I'm not injuring myself or it's not wrong to have, but it's just there in the background and, you know, it's cloudy today and I can meditate with the cloudy sky. I have a little pain in my leg and I can just meditate with it without any issue. So discomfort and physical pain of all kinds comes with human life. So to the degree to which some of it is unavoidable for human beings. To look at it then deeply, and one of the things we start seeing is not the discomfort itself, but the relationship we have to it. So I just described to you, kind of hopefully to be a little bit encouraging, that I have pain in my leg and I'm completely at ease with it and fine. That's just not an issue. And that kind of relationship is possible is very different than I'm sitting up here and I can have all kinds of reactivity to this here. I could get angry. I've been meditating 50 years. And by now, I should not be uncomfortable. It should be completely in bliss. I should be floating. I thought Buddhism was to kind of float in the clouds and, you know, just everything is kind of blissed out. And what am I doing? You know, this Buddhism is a failure. And I finally realized this Buddhism doesn't help me at all, you know, because I'm not in that bliss state that I thought the promise was. So that's one relationship, and some of you are laughing at me for having that ideas. And so that's, you know, that's a relationship I have to the pain that I would, and because you're laughing, you realize it's maybe a little bit ridiculous and silly to have that. It could be that I feel really discouraged. You know, wow, you know, and then there's also a big idea I shouldn't be feeling pain. It could be, you know, I'm embarrassed. You know, this is like, I shouldn't admit it. I'm a meditation teacher. You know, and, you know, they're going to think bad of me now. I should be able to, you know, sit here and just kind of, again, just be, you know, blissed out or something. So I can be angry at the pain. you know, that leg of mine, you know, and I'm going to get back at it. I had a friend who had knee pain in meditation, and he said that he would, whenever the knee hurt, he'd hurt it back. Push at it. So, you know, there's all kinds of odd relationships to pain, right, to discomfort. So we're embarrassed, we feel it shouldn't be there, we're angry at it, we're trying to escape it. Some people are incapable of being with certain kind of emotional discomfort, and they'll run away. They'll go for alcohol, for example, or sometimes sex, or sometimes Netflix, or whatever, you know, something, you know, just to get away from it, food, you know, and so they don't have to feel their discomfort. So when we do the mindfulness practice, one of the things we're learning how to do is to take a good look at the relationship we have with discomfort and see that the relationships, the attitudes that we have are different than the discomfort itself, whether it's physical or emotional discomfort. It's without a judgment about the discomfort, without the idea that you have to end all discomfort once and for all through Buddhism, but rather you're trying to understand that relationship we have so the relationship itself becomes one of ease and peaceful. So we're not adding unnecessary distress, pain, stress on top of our life by the reactivity we have with the discomfort. So the slogan I like for this is, we're learning to be comfortable with discomfort. That's a radical thing to do compared to what most people in our society know what to do. Some people have the idea that when they're uncomfortable, they're failed at something. You know, somehow to be a successful person, you have to kind of just never be in pain or never be uncomfortable with something. And you have to fix your discomfort at all costs. Life is a lot easier to go through if we're comfortable with discomfort. If we're not a slave to discomfort, pushed around by it and having to react and do with it. As we become freer in that way around discomfort, then we're in a much better position to look at the discomfort in a kind of objective, clear way and decide, is this healthy for me? Is this appropriate for me? So like the pain I feel in my legs, we're sitting here. I give it some careful attention and decide, okay, this is okay for now. I don't think I'm injuring myself. I don't know exactly what's going on, and probably I should do more stretching, you know, or something. Or maybe I should find a different posture to sit in. But because I'm studying it and looking at it, I can begin kind of coming to terms with it and to understand, well, maybe I shouldn't be this. I'm comfortable enough with having it, but maybe there's ways of fixing it that are appropriate. But now I'm going to fix it because of wisdom, because it just seems like a sensible thing to do, as opposed to fixing it because I'm angry or want to escape it or I have aversion towards it or I'm just really attached to comfort, you know. So it's, I need to get myself as comfortable as possible. That's what's cozy and I would love that. So what's the attitude? And so as the attitude becomes simpler and simpler and non-reactive, then we're in a better position to answer questions about the discomfort. Okay, this discomfort I can live with. This one I shouldn't live with. This requires a change. Now let's see a healthy way to do it. I don't think that just because I have leg pain, I should go now to the bar after this being here with you all and just kind of, drink away my pain. That I don't recommend that. So what's healthy? So discomfort. One of the things that's powerful for this investigation, and I think phenomenal, is to begin appreciating the difference between an event, here discomfort, but it could be any event we have, and our relationship to it. And we're beginning now to question and look at that relationship and clarify it. Some people it's called purify it, simplify it, free it, so that we're not caught in the grip of that relationship, and we're not caught in the grip of aversion and desire and all kinds of other things that are kind of driving us kind of they're controlling us rather than we controlling our inner life. Make some sense? So that's just that has been fantastic. So then we go to a deeper layer in this study, and we start looking at what can be called emotional pain. Is all emotional pain suffering, the Buddhist idea of dukkha? Or is emotional pain, some of it is the suffering, the Buddhist end, and some emotional pain just comes with human life? You have to answer that question for yourself. How do you answer that question? One of the ways is to look at your relationship to emotional pain. That's a kind of discomfort too, right? And so what you learn to do with like physical discomfort or ordinary discomfort now is addressed in this emotional pain. And you start seeing, well, I hate it. I really want to feel some other kind of happy feeling, and I'm chasing that. I feel shame. You know, I somehow I'm in Buddhist for a while now, and I thought Buddhists were supposed to be always equanimous and peaceful and cooled and chilled, and here I am kind of, you know, feeling a lot of agitation, and I guess I'm an embarrassment to the Buddhist world. And so that's a relationship, an attitude that we have to what's happening. And we start seeing all these layers of unnecessary judgments, unnecessary interpretations that are causing us distress or undermining us or discouraging us or something. And so the same study we did with discomfort, it can be done in relationship to emotional pain. And they're also the same lesson. We can learn to be comfortable with emotional pain. We can just be peaceful with it. And then we can study it more deeply. And lo and behold, one of the things you'll probably discover is that some of your emotional pain comes from some deeper reactivity. Some of the emotional pain you have becomes because you're really attached to something, clinging to something. And so, for example, if I can be so simple thing for me of wanting to get someplace on time because I wanted to go show up at IMC and teach people how to be non-attached and just be relaxed with what is and not get caught up. But there's a lot of traffic to get here, and I'm going to be late. And I got to get there right away, and it's important to get there right away, and people get to sleep, they'll all go away, and no one will be here, and I'll be giving a talk by myself. I have to get there, you know, teach them to be relaxed. And so there's frustration, there's anger at the traffic, but I'm clinging to something. I'm clinging to all kinds of things, what it means to be here, and I'm kind of clinging to the fear you'll all go home if I don't show up in time. And so if I'm mindful enough of what's happening for me there in the traffic, feeling all hot and sweaty and in a hurry, I say, oh, wait a minute, Gil. You're really attached to layers and layers of things here. Do you have to stay attached? Yes, the lawyers of the mind come up and say yes. But if I kind of can, you know, offer the counter arguments, then I said, no, I don't have to be. It doesn't do me any good. The traffic's not going to change. And it's not going to help me to be stressed and hold on to this attachment to be there on time. And so then I begin letting go and relaxing, and I feel so much better. So the anger with the traffic, the distress around the traffic, you start seeing, yes, I'm relaxed enough about it, but when I look more deeply at it, there's a lot of attachments connected to it. And so to look, and we find there's a lot of things we hold on to tight or we resist furiously. No, I'm not going to do that. Things we hate, things we want. And if we do an honest look at it, we'll discover that sometimes in it, in these emotions that we have, these painful emotions, that we're attached to something and clinging to something. If you don't see the clinging, if you don't see attachment, then there's no attachment to let go of. Maybe there are some emotional pains that are not supposed to be to end. You know, when someone dies and we feel grief, are we supposed to like now feel like we're a Buddhist failure? you know, I read the news and I feel pain. I feel heartbroken at some of the things I read. Am I not supposed to feel that? I kind of think, I don't have, want to live in a universe where I don't feel sad or feel grief or feel heartbroken over some of the things that I see happens in the world. It feels completely appropriate to feel that. But I don't think it's born from attachment for me. I don't think it's I'm clinging to something or resisting something. It just kind of comes through me, but it doesn't get stuck there. It just kind of, I feel it fully and clearly. And sometimes I've read news in the paper and started crying. At, you know, I have no idea. I have no thought that I'm not supposed to feel that and feel that pain. But if I stop and take a deeper look, I might see, yeah, in the corners of that, there's something I'm attached to and clinging to. But in the heart of it, no. It just seems very, very simple and clear. There's nothing. And so I just let it be there. And I don't add layers of suffering on top of it. Like, I'm not supposed to be this way, or I'm supposed to like get rid of it quickly. Grief is supposed to be, you know. After all, it's been 30 minutes now. And so I should be finished with my grief, you know. Or so we have all these attitudes that we add on top. And so we're learning more and more these attitudes and simplifying, and that we discover, well, some things, I don't see any attachments in this emotional pain, and I've learned how to be at ease with that. I've learned not to add anything on top of it. This, we're comfortable with discomfort, comfortable with feeling emotional pain. This is a phenomenal gift we can give to the world, because it means that you can be a friend to someone who is in pain, emotional pain. You can share in that pain even, but your own distress, you're not distressed, you're not upset, you're not attached, you're not getting afraid. On top of the heartbreak, you're able to be there in a full, honest, clear way to offer accompaniment and companionship and a safe kind of listening ear, a safe kind of companionship with someone, which is a phenomenal gift to give people who are in pain. Let's go for a walk together. You know, I'm willing to feel uncomfortable. It's okay. I know how to do this. And I'm just here with it. And we'll just breathe and be with it together. And I'm not trying to fix anything. I'm not trying to fix you. I'm not trying to fix myself. Some people who are compassionate caregivers, supposedly, they think they are really trying to avoid being uncomfortable themselves. They're so uncomfortable with the discomfort in the world that they're trying to get everyone fixed and good so they don't have to feel that discomfort. And I think that leads to often kind of unhealthy behavior. And so this ability to feel our emotional pain, separate out what is extra, the layers of reactivity, the layers of attachment and clinging, attitudes and beliefs. So it's simple, simple, simple. And then be able to go through the world and be with ourselves, I think, is a gift. So the third layer I want to talk about is the layer of me, myself, and mine. So as we're looking at suffering, as we turn towards a door of suffering and start going through it, some of that suffering is happening to me. Thank you. It's my suffering. And the attachment to self, the ideations around self, of course it's certain pain, like this pain in my knee. It's happening to me. There's no question about it. But it's also, I'm the ideation that this is my suffering, I'm suffering, I feel so sorry for myself, 50 years of meditation pains, you know, enough is enough, and, you know, I feel so sorry for myself, and I deserve a break, I deserve going to Hawaii and having a vacation, and I deserve something better, and, you know, and now we're entering this world of me, myself, and mine, how I think about this, and how I think the impact is on me, on what I need and stuff. And some of that's innocent. I mean, earlier on I said, I'll consider this pain and consider whether I need to change my posture. That's use of the word I is kind of innocent and simple. But, oh, poor Gil. And I hope I can really let you know how horrible and terrible it is that I'm suffering so much with my legs so that you'll feel sorry for me. And that'll be great. We'll have a Gil feeling sorry fest. As if that's going to help anyone, right? So this I thing can get really activated. So I want to suggest a little exercise. You're all sitting here, I think, and you're all sitting either in chairs or zafus, on the cushions on the floor. And if you're not, one person's leaning against a wall, so the wall is there. And say you have to go maybe to the bathroom. So you get up happily, go to the bathroom, and come back 5 minutes later. And someone is sitting in your place. That was my chair. That was my cushion that you took from, you know, one of our cushions here. You didn't bring it with you. So I thought, what are they doing sitting on my cushion? If you hadn't gone to the bathroom and just stayed here to the end and went home and came back next week, you would have no memory which cushion, which chair was yours. You wouldn't have that kind of idea. As soon as you leave, it's not yours anymore. The idea that it's your chair, your cushion, your spot, that does not exist in the natural world by itself out there. That belongs to what I call the ego-sphere, or the I-sphere, the me-sphere, that is kind of invisible. Like that chair that's empty now, sitting next to Lydia, right next to, someone sat there once upon a time. I don't have any clue who sat there, any clue who saw it, that's my chair. They didn't engrave their name in the side, you know, so we know it's their chair. It belongs to the world of mentality and thoughts and ideas. What is that world? What is the egosphere of thoughts and ideas and ideations that creates this me, myself, and mine? You know, does it have a weight? Does it have color? Does it have shape? Is it the shape of the chair? it's an unusual world that's kind of invisible to everyone else. If all of us went home today with different, because we took all our shoes off, right? If everyone who took their shoes off went home with different shoes than they came with, your shoes won't care. The shoes, you know, unless you wrote your name on it, but even then, you know, the shoes don't have any idea that they belong to you or you belong to them. Who belongs to who, right? And so these shoes don't have that idea. But boy, if you leave here now and your shoe's not on the rack when you leave, someone took my shoes. Yeah, or you could say, yeah, oh, the shoes I came with are not here now. Oh, well, I got to figure out what to do now. Oh, some other ones there. It happened to me once many years ago. I had Birkenstocks. My Birkenstocks were not, the Birkenstocks I came with were not there. Oh, but there's another pair. And it's the same size. And it's newer. And so the next week, we came back to IMC and discovered there was actually a three-way exchange of Birkenstocks that happened. And so again, things belong to us is somewhat arbitrary. It's somewhat an ideation, an idea that's imposed on things. But that imposition of ownership does not belong in the natural world out there. It belongs to this ego sphere, this thought sphere, ideation sphere that we kind of are swimming in. And we're swimming in it as a society, and we support it. We, you know, and there's even laws that support the ownership of property and ownership of things. And so it has a kind of very strong pressure and kind of a orientation that's intense. Does that make it true? The fact that it's legally true? I mean, these the lands that we live on, they say, you know, we're appreciating more and more that many of us here in the United States are living on land that was stolen from people. And the fact that it was stolen from them in horrible ways sometimes, genocide and the fact that I bought the property that I'm living on, does that mean really it's mine, given that it's stolen property to begin with? Do descendants of the indigenous people still have a claim? Could they have a claim? What happens if an indigenous family came to the property that I own and say, you know, my family lived here for generations, and so we have a relationship to this land. Would I say, well, this is my property, I'm going to put up a bigger fence now to keep you out? Is that the right thing to do for someone like that? What's their relationship to the land? We bought this house, actually, a little side story, up here many years ago. And in the basement, they left this huge ancient desk, which was kind of like, you know, wooden desk, big, wide, with big drawers. And it was kind of a classic from the 1920s or something. And I kind of liked it, but the top of it was completely warped, so I put a new top on it. It took a long time to figure out how to do it. And then some years ago, someone came to our house and said, you know, my grandparents lived here before you, you know, some, you know, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and we used to come visit all the time. And we just wanted to see it. And so, great, come and look. And looked around and showed them the basement and said, oh, that's the desk. It's really big, so different owners over the years never took it out because it's kind of hard to get out. And I said, would you like it? Oh, yes. You know, it belonged to their family at one point and had an emotional connection. So ownership and what belongs to who, and did it belong to me? It was just left there. I guess legally it would be, but does it really? So ownership. And then we have identity. And identity is a hot topic. It's so hot topic these days, I feel like I shouldn't even use the word. As soon as I say the word identity, I'm going to upset someone. but it's a difficult topic, right? But it's a very important one to address and to look at in our society these days. But the issue of identity is also complicated. And you know, for example, my identity as a teacher. Is that complicated? Should that be complicated or easy for me? If I go home with the identity of a teacher, it's a problem. It seems to work okay here. And until the identity of being a teacher becomes my value as a human being is dependent on that identity. And whatever else thinks about me in that identity. And now we're getting into dangerous territory. And now I'm going to have to give a talk that's brilliant. You know, the pressure is on and all kinds of things, right? So we're talking about an invisible world that belongs to this world of the thought sphere that most people can't see exactly for yourself. What we identify, some of the things we identify with, some of the things we take as mine, some of the ways we define ourselves, ideas of ownership. And I do this sometimes, and I find it meaningful. I don't know if it'll be meaningful for you, but just look around the room, the ceiling, the walls, the lights, and just look around. And where do you find me in it? where's I in all that? Where's mine in all that? It's probably it's not there. Has any of you had this thought that the chandeliers are mine? Or I'm the chandeliers? It's just lights. It's just walls. It's just, you know, free of that sense of self. And to turn that kind of attention inward, to what degree can you turn it inward and have the same kind of experience where you're looking at parts of yourself inside experiences and you see, oh, that's not me. That's just phenomena. That's just things happening. You know, an exercise I've done many times is, maybe it doesn't work so much now anymore, it's so long ago, this song, but maybe, you know, I'm going to have a thought arise in your mind that you didn't put there, you didn't want to have, you're going to try to resist me, don't have this thought, and as this thought arises, is this thought you? Is this define who you are, or is that me making this thought, or is it, what is it that's, it's your brain, but does this make sense to call this me, myself, and mine? It just, conditions come together. The hills are alive with the sound of, maybe some of you of a certain age, probably couldn't help for your mind to finish that sentence. And so to have that thought, is that you? You know, does it quite make sense to claim that that's you? It's just, you know, it's just a response the brain has to me saying something. You know, so you have the wind brushes against your cheek. Is that experience of sensations in your cheek? Is the sensations itself me, myself, and mine? It's happening to you. Do you want to claim ownership of it? Do you want to define yourself by that sensation? Do you cause the sensation? Did you orchestrate it and design it? It's just kind of, no, that's not me. And what we learn in Buddhist meditation is to begin questioning and looking deeper and deeper around this ideation, this I sphere, the ideation sphere that we swim in, and begin seeing how much of it we don't have to do. And we can quiet that, the thinking mind that creates me, myself, and mine is a little bit of a wind drag, or very much a wind drag for the mind. And as we slow down and quiet, we begin letting go of the wind drag. And it can be blissful and peaceful to, because so much of this me, myself, and mine comes with attachment, comes with resistance, comes with tightening up, comes with, it's also the me, myself, and my thoughts that we have are some of the primary kind of inner ideations we have that's a source of our reactivity. When we react automatically, habitually, for or against things, it has a lot to do with this identification with self that exists within us. And we start seeing how much it's not part of the natural world, but part of our ideations and thoughts and ideas. And we see that really clearly in meditation, because it requires processing activity in the brain to have these thoughts. And as the mind gets calmer and calmer and calmer, we do less and less this thinking this way. And we get calm enough, we see that if I start thinking that those Birkenstocks out in the shelf are my Birkenstocks, just that thought itself, see, it's like that's agitated. The mind now has gotten agitated. It's true enough, but my thought, why would I want to agitate my mind when I'm so peaceful? Let's not have any more Birkenstock thoughts in meditation. You know, I can do that later. And so, but that example, in so many different ways, we start seeing clearly, I don't have to think this way. Maybe it's okay way to think for later. And then it becomes a really kind of a revolutionary thing to experience ourselves without this I sphere, this ideation sphere operating. So the topic of today is how to study your suffering. The vantage point of studying our suffering without the ideation of self is a radical revolutionary change. Because there's a whole layers of reactivity, of emotional pain, that belong to that ideation around me, myself, and mine. And if you can really see that, that changes the whole understanding of what emotional pain is just an ordinary part of human life and what is unnecessary. And a lot of people will want to justify their emotional pain because it's just natural, this is part of life. But it's not really that natural because you see, it's part of the reactivity around this created construct of me, myself, and mine. That's been constructed with the help of our society, our family, our life experiences, how we've been treated by people, by our desires and wants and advertisements. All kinds of things have built together. And it feels so natural to be yourself that it's very hard to see how much your whole sense of self is a construct that's been built up over a lifetime. And there's very few things that can help you kind of break through that. Meditation is one of them. And I think meditation is, another one is psychedelics, you know, which we're not supposed to encourage here. And I think meditation is more powerful in the long term. So since I made that the P word. I lived in the biggest psychedelic hippie commune in the country back in the early 70s. But they decided, because of legal issues, to stop using psychedelics. And so they wanted to find the next best thing. And the next best thing was honesty. And that's why I stayed with them. I'd never been around people who were so honest. I was so inspired by it. So anyway, so honesty, meditation, other things, to really see clearly what's going on here. So suffering and the end of suffering. It's for you to discover what suffering you can end. But suffering is always a door to go through. And to have confidence and skill and to build up the capacity to be willing to stop and look at suffering. Stop and take it, go through that door. It's really worthwhile to go through that door. Because one way or the other, you can get to the other side. And what that other side should look like, no one can tell you. It's not supposed to be floating in the clouds. It's going to be your own way. And so, really, no one can answer these questions except yourself. That's why mindfulness and deeper looking is really so important. And I hope you do answer those questions for yourself. And you probably answer the questions differently over time. And if you really kind of get a handle on this whole I sphere, ideation sphere that we live under, you probably answer the questions differently than you do before you really address this part of your life. So I hope that you are inspired to do this work. I hope you come to a time where you enjoy doing it. You're delighted it. It inspires you. It's like such a wonderful thing to have the good fortune to have a practice and a means to really step into this. I think of it as a way of stepping into being fully human. If we're running away from our pain and discomfort and our suffering, we're actually shutting off or shutting down part of our full humanity. Step in through that door of suffering and you'll be much happier. Thank you.